Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September the 11th, what questions remain unanswered? Which ones may not be asked? We'll take a look at recent research from Dr. David Ray Griffin, his newest book, Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. Later in the program, we'll talk about the state of academic freedom surrounding 9/11 research and other controversial issues with Dr. Anthony Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September 11th, we look at the recent work of Dr. David Ray Griffin, who has numerous books on the events of September 11th, and his newest book explores the crimes of Bush and Cheney. Later in the program, we'll talk about academic freedom in 9/11 with Dr. Anthony Hall. But first, here's Peter to introduce David Ray Griffin to you. Peter?
David Ray Griffin is a professor emeritus of philosophy of religion and theology at Claremont School of Theology and Claremont Graduate University. He's written many books, one of which is The New Pearl Harbor, but the newest book is Bush and Cheney and How They Ruined America and the World. And that's what we're going to be talking to David about. Hello, David.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Nikki.
It's great to have you here. I read your book this week, and I really enjoyed it because it frames a number of things, including 9/11, as a pivotal point in this century. And you refer to 9/11 and Bush and Cheney, who were in charge at that time of the U.S. government, as a pivot point in terms of our Constitution. You call after 9/11 sort of a post-constitutional era. What do you mean by that?
It's the fact that the Bill of Rights has been pretty much shredded. And that's a term that is widely used now. And that's one of the problems with 9/11 that most people are not aware of. Everybody knows about Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, you know, and America and the world. In America, Cheney went through and pretty much shredded the at least some part of the Bill of Rights. And then Obama, he didn't like to do things that were illegal, so he went through and made all the things that Cheney had done legal, at least to, you know, appear to be legal.
That included arresting people, you know, or spying on people without warrants, torturing people, and basically an overall observation of the public without any due process, correct?
That's right, and I must say that chapter is pretty complex, so it's difficult to discuss on air, at least for me. So on that one, I would hope people would particularly take time to read that chapter, because I think that will surprise them. And as I say at the end of that chapter, you know, the situation has been set for some potential demagogue to come along and take advantage of the shredded Bill of Rights, and then sure enough, we got a potential demagogue, and we don't know how that's going to work out.
Well, David Ray Griffin, I won't mince the words. We have a demagogue, and Bush and Cheney kind of paved the way. Obama worked to normalize what could almost be described as a neoliberal form of soft fascism. And, you know, his attack on the Bill of Rights continued with the NDAA, deportations, the silencing of whistleblowers. And now it's as if it's just unbridled and the mask is taken off. And we just have an amazing degree of hostility toward marginalized communities, toward the global population. This is writ large a 1% tyranny. And Donald Trump is, of course, a symptom of this. He's certainly not the mastermind. But talk to us a little more specifically how we got here through the Bush and Cheney regimes, because you detail so many things in your book. We have, of course, the state of emergency after 9/11, the Afghan war that is unending, apparently. We've normalized preemptive war. We've gone through the roof with military spending. We're still in Iraq. We have a crisis of Islamophobia and global chaos. You go through this in great detail. Walk us through a little bit of this and give listeners, again, sort of a teaser for the contents of the book.
Yeah, well, you sort of listed there the chapter headings and the first part of the book. In fact, let me begin by saying, usually people ask me, why did I write this book? And what happened was I had virtually promised my wife, after I did my 2011 book, that I wouldn't do any more 9/11 books. And then I spent 3 years working on climate change, a big book on that.
You did, and you kept your promise.
For a few years.
That's good.
But about a year and a half ago, I started just seeing just a whole slew of stories in the press pointing out how the world has pretty much self-destructed since 9/11. Now, a lot of people would say since the Iraq War, but others will say really since 9/11, and that's what I say. So I thought, well, I'll make one more effort to break through. And so what I tried to do in my previous book, like my most extensive book on 9/11 was The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, written in 2008. So I go through there and tell almost everything that's wrong with the official story of 9/11. Well, I've learned that, you know, people who haven't lived and breathed this for several years get so lost and it gets so complex. And they say, you know, I can't do anything about 9/11. It's too complex. It would take me too long to get up to speed. And so I decided, well, you know, you really don't need to know all those details. All you really need to know is the fact that on 9/11, major miracles occurred. And by a miracle, I mean it in the technical sense that was used by David Hume in the 18th century and is used by physicists now. A miracle is something that is physically and chemically impossible. So, you know, most of the people in the press, you say, well, do you believe in miracles? Oh, of course not. That's, you know, stupid stuff. But what they don't realize is insofar as they endorse this official story, they're endorsing these major miracles that just could not have happened.
You're referring specifically to the collapse of the World Trade Centers and Building 7.
Well, yeah.
As miracles because...
And Hani Hanjour.
Yeah, most of the miracles are with the World Trade Centers, the Twin Towers and Building 7. And when you look at it, you just see it's just ridiculous to think that anybody's believed this, and yet they so frightened people. They got people to the point that they wouldn't even look at 9/11. You say, "Oh no, I don't go there," and so they won't even look at the fact that they would not believe it if they would do it. It's too scary, and scary in the sense that they pretty well believe. I don't think this is true anymore, but certainly during the Bush-Cheney years, and I think during Obama years, if you really questioned the official story, you'd be quite likely to lose your job and lose your reputation. And a lot of people, most people, just say, well, you know, it's not worth it. I go out on a limb here, and it won't make any difference whatsoever. So I just won't do it, and I'll just keep it to myself. So my strategy in the book was to, first of all, get people to see how much the world has changed and been ruined since 9/11 itself. And then secondly, to see how obviously false the official story is. And then thirdly, hoping that that combination of facts would embolden some people to say, look, we say we defend the Constitution, we defend the United Nations, we want to defend the Earth, and we see now the only way we can do it is by revealing the falsity of the 9/11 official story. And so if I do it on my own, sure, I'll lose my job, I'll lose my reputation, and so on. You know, I won't be interviewed on the Rachel Maddow show. But
or you won't get to go back and see Tucker Carlson.
But if we could get like 50 really solid people whose reputations are such that, you know, it'd be very difficult for anybody to ridicule them as individuals. And certainly, if you got 50 of these people together saying the same thing, it would be very difficult. So this is my hope with the book. And, you know, it's a very long shot, but I thought I had to try.
Well, you identify Bush and Cheney as key to this, certainly right after 9/11, and at least allowing 9/11 to happen, because they had many, many warnings and could have preempted the whole event. But, you know, that danger is certainly there. And
just a minute, let me interrupt. Don't even talk about the possibilities that they just let it happen. If you look at the World Trade Center, everything parted. There's no way they could have just let it happen. They caused it to happen. And those are the miracles. They created the miracles.
Are you talking Bush and Cheney created the miracles, or subsets of the deep state intelligence world created?
I don't get into these details who did it, but of course we know a lot of people say, oh, Bush and Cheney, they couldn't have done anything. They were so stupid. Well, yeah, Bush, but not Cheney. Cheney had been the Secretary of Defense, so he knows all about how planes can come in and cause havoc by seeming to be having mistakes. So, yeah, I would say that. They were responsible, and, of course, Rumsfeld was in charge of the Pentagon, and he and Cheney, of course, were best friends. They had worked together in the House as they first got started in politics. So when I say Bush and Cheney, I could have said Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, but then I could have also added the leading Secretary of Defense at the time.
The New American Century. Yeah, all the players
You know, you could have a very long title for the book. So I just say Bush and Cheney.
Bush and Cheney and how they ruined the world, which they did. Certainly their involvement and awareness of 9/11 is crystal clear to me and many others in this country. And the Mineta testimony around Cheney and the bunker at the White House and all of that is certainly suspect. But, you know, more importantly, and
let me focus in on that issue, because, you know, what they did is Cheney went down to the underground bunker, the PIOC, a little before 9:30. And then they start getting frightened that, you know, they're going to think Cheney, having been in the PIOC and being in charge, might have been responsible for the attack on the Pentagon. And then there was also the problem with the plane going to Pennsylvania. So they just changed the time and said that Cheney did not get into the PIOC until 9:57 or 9:58. So everything had already happened, so there was no way that Cheney could have been responsible for these things. Who knows where he was? He was somehow wandering around the White House. That's what the 9/11 Commission did, and that's what they did. And that became the official story, and hardly anybody knows about the Mineta story, because it couldn't have happened because Cheney wasn't down there.
David, what is PEOC? Tell our listeners.
Presidential Emergency Operations Center.
Okay.
Just known as the bunker.
Right. I'd like to remind listeners, this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking right now with Dr. David Ray Griffin. His most recent book, Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. We'll continue our conversation with David Ray Griffin after this brief musical break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, for the 16th anniversary of the events of 9/11, we're joined by scholar Dr. David Ray Griffin, author of over 10 books on 9/11, including his newest, Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World. Before the break, David, you were talking about the Normanetta testimony and how the 9/11 Commission, edited by Philip Zelikow, who wrote works with Condoleezza Rice at Project for New American Century, and all the connections these people have behind the scenes. But I wanted to go back to that if you wanted to finish the story with Mineta and how the commission made it such that his testimony under oath couldn't be true.
Well, that's right. The press have just accepted that official story. And if you tell people, you know, it's not true. I mean, there's all the evidence that Cheney was down there before 9:30 and therefore 10 or more minutes before the attack on the Pentagon. And the Mineta story, there was about a young man who would keep coming into the PIOC and saying, the plane is getting closer, and he'd come back again, and now it's getting closer. And finally, it's very close. Do the orders still stand? And Cheney said, well, of course. Hey, you know, have you heard anything to the contrary? So it seems like the order clearly was to stand down. Well, that was very problematic for that to become public. Here was Mineta on public television, and there's no way they could stop him from telling that story. And so they had to figure out how to clean it up. Well, now we have proof that the Mineta story was true and that the 9/11 Commission told a big lie, because we have three separate statements by members of the Secret Service saying that, here's one of them, it says, Danny Spriggs, the Secret Service assistant, got down to the PIOC at 9:30, and he said, presidential and vice presidential staff and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice were already there. And then a couple other statements like that. So now there is no doubt, and if you had a press that would dig into this like they dig into stories about Trump or stories about almost anything else, this would be an obvious one to do, because if Cheney and the 9/11 Commission lied in something that is provably a lie, then that throws the whole 9/11 theory into question. But, of course, we do not have that kind of press.
Well, David, after 16 years, it seems pretty clear to me and Mickey that the corporate media is not going to examine this. They'll continue to say that we're crazy conspiracy theorists to even think about these issues, and that's part of the problem. But your book is even broader than just that. I mean, part two is all the miraculous things that happened, and I love that section. But, you know, in part one, you're really laying out how the world has changed, that our Constitution has been shredded, that the concept of a unitary presidency, a president with power to engage in preemptive wars, that is, we can invade countries as a preemptive act. And this is really an important piece, because one of the stories of Project Censor this year is that the United States special operations are killing people in over 140 countries in the world. So we are the military global empire, and NATO, along with us, that has been allowed to expand worldwide because of 9/11. In fact, Trump's speech on his extended war in Afghanistan talked about 9/11. He mentioned that at least a half a dozen times. So it's still the justification. So talk about what we've lost as a society in that capacity.
So many, many respects. One is that we've never had a perfect press. They already covered up the Kennedy assassination, for example, both Kennedy assassinations, where they were obviously, the official story was false. Even more obviously with Bobby, you got him allegedly shot from the front, and yet all the bullets go into his back, and the press covered that up. So for a long time, we've had that kind of press, but it's gotten much worse now, where it's just very difficult. So, you know, people get mad at Trump for talking about fake news. And it is problematic, because he generally talks about stuff as fake news that's critical of him. But there is, as you know, so much of the mainstream news is fake news to some degree or another. So there's that problem. There's the problem of the reputation of the United States. Another book that I've been working on is sort of a prequel to this, is, you know, the history of the American empire, raising the question, is America blessed or cursed? Is it something to be proud of, or is it, as we like to say, God-inspired, or is it more demonic? And I was sort of surprised even to see that a large number of people now say American empire is evil, and that it is the major source of evil in the world, in the international relations.
So, David Ray Griffin, the aftermath of 9/11 certainly is what you're looking at in your latest book, specifically through the lens of Bush and Cheney. And just to wrap this segment here, just a final question for you. I'm assuming I know the answer to this, but what do you hope that you're going to accomplish here with your latest work on 9/11?
Well, I already said that I would hope that some real patriots who have impeccable reputations would get together and say, look, let's join forces here and try to do what we can to save the nation and save the world by revealing this enormous lie about 9/11. One other point I want to make clear is, although Bush and Cheney are in the title, it's really a book about the neocons. And so there's a lot about Hillary Clinton. Of course, when I wrote this book, I thought she was going to become the president, and she was threatening to go in and totally take out Assad in Syria. She even wants to bring about regime change in Russia, and, you know, they would frown on that with their nuclear weapons. You know, it's just become such a frightening world. And then we say, well, you know, Trump's really bad, and let's get rid of him, and he really is bad. But when you get rid of Trump, you bring in Pence, and he's a neocon. So whether you had Hillary or you get Pence, you get the neocons back in charge.
Well, essentially, you're saying that the neocons have been around since Bush the First in many capacities, and that is reflective of where our government is today. That you know, and that we're in danger, and it's a danger of not only ecological holocaust, which is one of your chapters, but a nuclear holocaust as well. And now we have someone in power in the presidency who's not only influenced by the neocons, but is capable of initiating warfare that could lead to nuclear exchanges. So we're very concerned about all this, and we certainly applaud your work here. It's very important work. The book is called Bush and Cheney, How They Ruined America and the World, just out by David Ray Griffin from Olive Branch Press. We highly recommend it. And David, thank you so much for being on with us.
Thanks, guys.
Really appreciate it.
I'd like to remind listeners that this is the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. After this brief musical break, we'll return to our 16th anniversary program about the events of 9/11. We'll be speaking with Dr. Anthony Hall about academic freedom surrounding 9/11 and other controversial issues. Please stay with us.
Seized our jet senator hijack. They flew into the towers with a mighty impact. Trade Center fell in, total collapse. Now Bush is in the classroom for a photo op show. The story of the goat is what he wants kids to know. The day is 9/11, year 2001. Now who the hell's attacking us and what's to be done? Do the orders still stand, sir? Do the orders still stand? Do the orders. Stand. Transportation Secretary, he testified. By 9:20 a.m., he was by Cheney's side. Cheney's in charge in the White House war room. When did the teleconference start? It evolved whom? Nanetta said a young man asked Cheney in doubt. Does the order still stand, sir? The 50 miles out. The 30 miles out, sir, he reports to command. The plane is 10 miles out, sir. Do the order still stand? Do the order still stand, sir? Do the order still stand? Do the order still stand, sir? Do the order still stand? Do the order still stand?
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September 11th, we're looking at what questions remain unanswered, which ones may not be asked. And in this segment, we're joined by Professor Tony Hall. He is a co-anchor and a researcher. Tony Hall is a full-tenured professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada. He's worked there for 25 years, during which time he's published articles in many venues, including Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Ottawa Citizen, also the Dictionary of Canadian Biography, Literary Review of Canada, so many more. And he also has made many presentations to the Canadian parliamentary committees and served as an expert witness on constitutional issues on legal cases in Canada and the United States. He also is author of The American Empire and the Fourth World, as well as Earth into Property, Colonization, Decolonization, and Capitalism, both by McGill Queen's University Press. He also has a program with Dr. Kevin Barrett, and it is a show, False Flag Weekly News. Tony Hall, welcome back to the Project Censored Show. It's been a while.
Yeah, hi.
Thanks so much for joining us in the program today, Tony. And I know we have some serious issues to discuss regarding academic freedom and things that have been happening with you this past year. But as a segue into that, and we want you to tell that story, tell us about, again, how you got involved in 9/11 research. And that's, of course, where we originally met and had you on the program.
Yeah, I was pressured by my friend and colleague, John Boncourt, sometimes called Splitting the Sky, Dakajewia, a Mohawk activist. And we had worked together on various issues, and in 2008, he said, Tony, you've got to get off the fence on 9/11. And I had looked at it as a blowback, and I had written about it in one of my big volumes, The American Empire and the Fourth World, as blowback. Anyway, he came and spoke in my class, and I brought myself up to speed, and my gosh, the evidence of what really happened does not conform with the official story, no doubt about it. Splitting the Sky went on the subsequent year to attempt the citizen's arrest of George W. Bush in Calgary, Alberta, a credibly accused war criminal, of course. So that became an interesting basis of collaboration, including with Dr. Kevin Barrett, with whom I currently work as co-host on False Flag Weekly News, and we found a lot in common. Dr. Barrett lost his job at the University of Wisconsin in 2006 for insisting on doing his job in his Islamic studies class and looking at 9/11 and its effects on Islamic people, Muslim people. So I took it up as a research subject and began to teach about it and research about it and write about it and come to Berkeley and speak with you and Peter and hello, Peter. And increasingly, I sort of found that it was necessary to go beyond the kind of analysis of what happened on that day in terms of sort of a physical description. You inevitably start getting interested in the idea, well, if it wasn't the people named Islamic terrorists acting independently with box cutters and such, somebody did it, and who did it? And of course, that leads into perilous waters, I suppose, the question of starting to speculate about who actually did do it.
Tony, hi. This is Peter Phillips. Give us, in a nutshell, what you think happened and who was behind 9/11. And David is saying that Bush and Cheney were certainly part of it, or certainly Cheney was, and allowed it to happen or even helped make it happen. We don't know for sure what else was there, but where are you on all of that?
Yeah, well, let's be clear that ultimately we need to have trials, and we do have a principle that has been betrayed, that people are innocent until proven guilty. And I would like to think that in the long run, we have to stand for this principle, habeas corpus. But speculating in general terms, who had the incentive to do it, who had the means to do it, let me say that I'm looking at a letter from my university president on October the 3rd, 2016, suspending me from teaching, taking me out of the classroom, cutting my pay to zero, it's since been turned on, taking very harsh recriminatory actions. And the main allegation against me is that I did infer that Israelis, and hence Jewish individuals, were responsible for the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. Those are the words of my university administration. And I do take responsibility to pointing to the fact that many of the people involved in the prelude to 9/11 were in the Project for the New American Century. Many of them were dual citizens of Israel and the United States. And there is a faction within Israel and within the United States called the neocons. And the neocons have a very extravagant idea of U.S.'s future, but also Israel's future. And, of course, Israel is in a territory where they're surrounded by Muslim people, by Arab people. So 9/11, by saying that it was Islamic terrorists, largely Muslim people, acting out of zealotry, this can be pictured, and I do conceive it, as a kind of psychological operation. Essentially, the Cold War was over. The Soviet Union was no longer there, was no longer a credible enemy. The military-industrial complex needed a new enemy, and an enemy was created on September the 11th, 2001. And immediately before the Twin Towers even fell, Ehud Barak was on BBC saying that it was Osama bin Laden, it was Al-Qaeda, that there needed to be a concerted war on terror. This is in the very first hours. This is a former prime minister of Israel. And Benjamin Netanyahu, in the Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism in 1979, had more or less laid out, the people involved in that conference, the scenario that we're now in, the global war on terror, based on this interpretation of 9/11. Of course, 9/11 would have had to have many people involved, many interest companies that want to sell planes and bombs and all kinds of weaponry, all kinds of financial interests. But who was the directing agency? You know, I found very compelling the evidence brought forward in the military teaching apparatus of the United States by Alan Sabrowski, Dr. Alan Sabrowski, and he was very clear about the role of Israel. There is the work of Christopher Bolin and, of course, Kevin Barrett, who is very well informed on these issues and talks to everybody who has something of significance to say about new revelations on 9/11 and subsequent episodes of false flag terrorism. He takes a very clear line that it was a Zionist job, essentially, a global coup d'etat. And I find that compelling. I find that the evidence does point in that direction. And to imagine that 9/11 was an attempt by zealous Islamic extremists to create a global caliphate, that they somehow got through the whole military-industrial complex system, the intelligence states with box cutters, pulled this off, nobody is fired. I mean, that's an audacious interpretation. But the interpretation that since 9/11, you see what happened, and you see how, for instance, when the Israeli government talks about Palestinians and the thousands of Palestinians in dungeons and the recriminations against them and such, they're often talking about quote-unquote terrorists. And being able to label people who might have in former times be considered freedom fighters as quote-unquote terrorists and change laws and have an enormous surveillance state and you know, military invasions of largely Muslim-majority countries, when you see what happened after 9/11, it's pretty clear that the objectives of a faction within Israel, the Kudnik Israel, a faction within Zionism, not the labor Zionist version, which were, you know, was conducting negotiations with Palestinians, land for peace and that kind of thing. But since the Clean Break document of 1996, that has sort of been put on the side. And we have a very aggressive, expansionistic government in Israel with huge support in the United States. And in all our Western countries, there is a strong Zionist lobby, an Israeli-centric lobby that keeps not only our governing parties very much in line with Israeli foreign policy, but also the opposition parties. We don't have much formal debate in our parliaments on our relationship with Israel. So the world changed, these massive changes that took place. Was it the United States sort of acting some sort of inside job within the United States, or was there a sort of external, strong external influence on U.S. policy? And we know that, you know, it's no secret that there is a APEC. You know, U.S. government is permeated with a lot of Israel-first influence, and that has to be interpret it as part of the new era where we don't really have respect for constitutions and human rights and bills of rights and academic freedom, for instance, that, you know, another rule is in place. And, you know, I have been suspended for talking about.
Tony, I'd like to step in here because I'm following everything you're saying. I cannot come to the same conclusions that you have. Nothing that you said is inaccurate per se. Christopher Boland does make these claims, although I've read his book and I do not accept that Mossad was behind, or there's certainly not the evidence there that they were behind the building collapses on 9/11. However, having said that, Mossad certainly was aware that the events were going to happen. They had people across the river filming that, and that's certainly the circumstantial evidence that they knew in advance that was going to happen, because their people got arrested because the local police thought they were Arabs and, you know, and the whole thing. So that became part of this initial understanding that many other intelligence agencies were aware that these events were going to happen. Certainly the Russians were, Israel had forewarned, and in fact Israel had forewarned the United States that these events were going to happen. So Peter Dale Scott talks about that there were probably four or five plots that were ongoing from different sources that all kind of came together on 9/11, but no single monolithic control person is evident, or are we aware of that? But you've been making these statements, and you got into serious trouble at your university around it, partly because I think you became a target because you were making these statements. So tell us what happened.
Yes. Well, just to respond a little bit before I get into that, Peter, you bring forward what you consider to be the relevant evidence, and we're having a discussion, and you disagree with me, and that is fine. That's legitimate. That's what we're supposed to do. I mean, I might respond and say, well, how do you read this report that came out from the Project for the New American Century that said, you know, there should be something like a new Pearl Harbor? Probably Wolfowitz wrote that comment. And lo and behold, a year later, there was something like a new Pearl Harbor.
Which I fully acknowledge.
There are many factions involved. Yeah. It's not a simple story, that there are many interests involved. And I'm choosing to talk about what I believe to be the most compelling explanation, and it's, you know, we haven't had trials, we haven't had proper investigations.
Right.
We're put in a position where we have to speculate. So last October, early October, I got a letter.
Tony Hall, I just wanted to interject one thing very quickly, that this is exactly why we need to focus on academic freedom and the rights to academic freedom and research to delve into these kinds of controversial subjects. And this is, in fact, what it's at stake here beyond you personally, is an attack on academic freedom for researching controversial topics in a nutshell. So please continue with the story of what happened last October.
In October, I got this letter. It was in midterm, saying that I was suspended. I was suspended without pay, that I would not be permitted to set foot on my campus where I taught for 27 years. I'm a tenured professor and full professor. And so if this could be done with me, who else can it be done to? The whole idea of tenure is it's supposed to protect those senior professors who've passed through the necessary filters and vetting and such to make sure they can handle this responsibly. It's to protect us so that we can address controversial issues, issues that have a lot of effect on how powerful interests negotiate their way in society. So I was suspended. Several weeks prior to that, a reprehensible Facebook item had been placed on my Facebook wall. I was not aware of it. This Facebook item had an ugly picture, and it said the Holocaust didn't happen, and it referred to Jewish people as kikes, and it said, actually, kill all Jews, every last one. A really reprehensible post. I've traced it back to, I think it might be Joshua Goldberg who created it. But in any case, I did not create it. I did not permit it to go on my Facebook wall. I wasn't even aware of it until mid-September. And by that time, an organization called B'nai B'rith Canada, an extension of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith.
Tony Hall, let's be clear that you emphatically disagree with all of the statements from that post on your wall.
Yes, and I did condemn the reprehensible contents of that post on False Flag Weekly News in mid-September. And that was, you know, publicly broadcast, and you can watch that condemnation. It's posted online, the web show False Flag Weekly News. Nevertheless, this planted Facebook post established a momentum to a smear campaign, and then suddenly people are talking about False Flag Weekly News and, you know, my interpretations about 9/11. And I'm often on press TV. I've been to conferences in Tehran, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I speak on the Islamic Broadcasting Network, Press TV, and many of the stories that I comment on have to do with different Israeli incursions on Palestinians, on the expansion of the illegal settlements, and these kind of issues. So there's a lot online that indicates I have become a critic of Israel's treatment, the Israeli government's treatment of Palestinians, and I look at the discussion or lack of discussion in different countries, including my own Canada, and see a sort of failure of public discourse on these issues. There's a lot of paranoia around these issues, and clearly people might look at this and say, well, it's really not a good career move to talk about some of these controversial issues. The way I looked at it as a senior professor in a Canadian university with the protections of tenure, who is going to talk about it? Who is going to deal with these issues if not somebody in my position? So I, you know, published extensively on this. I also, in Earth into Property, which is a peer-reviewed book published by an academic publisher, you know, I deal with the history of 9/11, and I bring forward my interpretation of 9/11, not as developed as it is now. So since that time, the Canadian Association of University Teachers has got involved in the matter. I was suspended outside the protections of tenure, outside the collective agreement of my University of Lethbridge. So the Faculty Association has taken up the case. It went to court for the first time on August the 8th. I have a defamation case against the president of the university and the board of governors, and we have a freedom of information investigations going forward to see how this planted Facebook post was manipulated inside the Alberta government with the premier's office and the minister of justice's offices. There was a letter coming to the president Mann of my university on September the 1st. This happened, I remind you, on August 26th. The letter said that these horrific phrases came from my lips and I should be fired. So the fact that false information was created to smear me, disinformation was created to smear me, you know, is kind of an indicator that, well, I do say controversial things. Why wasn't it enough to just point to what I actually do say? You know, Peter has taken exception with some of the things I say, and I know it's a very touchy subject, but this is what universities are for. I mean, this is where we need to have these discussions. So I invite people who may disagree with me to bring forward evidence to show why I'm wrong in my speculations or conclusions. But I don't think it is appropriate that you just suspend a person, you pull them out of the classroom, you attempt to shut them up. And Dr. Griffin was talking about bringing forward people of very spotless reputations to talk on these issues. Well, after that Facebook post and the what has been stirred up, obviously this is, you know, very difficult on my reputation. It's an attempt to ruin me professionally, to take away the credibility of my voice if you know, I'm associated with such horrific slanders that have been put in my mouth. And actually an organization like the Canadian Jewish Civil Rights Association actually says these words came out of my mouth. So I have a job to do to try to change the record, you know, to, of course, mainstream media has reported on all of this, and I'm having a difficult time telling my side of the story. To this day, the president of the University of Lethbridge never asked me once for my side of the story. I've never talked to him about any subject. Why would he not call me into his office around September 1st, 2016, and ask me what was going on? Why did that not happen?
Tony, I need to interject quickly. Remind our listeners, I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. After our brief musical break, we'll be back to finish our interview with Dr. Anthony Hall about academic freedom surrounding issues of 9/11. Stay with us. ¶¶ Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's show, for the 16th anniversary of the events of September 11, we earlier spoke with Dr. David Ray Griffin, and now we're joined by Dr. Anthony Hall. He is a professor at the University of Lethbridge and author of numerous books and articles. He is at the center of a firestorm of a controversy surrounding 9/11 and academic freedom, where he is being accused of anti-Semitic remarks that were placed on his social media walls by another individual that had nothing to do with Tony Hall. So, Tony, continue some of this narrative and what you are doing about it in terms of libel or defamation, given the facts of the case.
Well, actually, the university administration seems not to want to talk about the original Facebook post. They certainly want to talk about what we talk about on False Flag Weekly News, and they seem to want to change the subject away from how this all began on August 26th. One of the things that I'm doing in my personal capacity, I'm being represented by the Faculty Association at the local level and the national level, but in my personal capacity, I'm suing the president of the university, Mike Mann, and the Board of Governors, and I'm particularly focusing on public statements, one of which was made by Dr. Mann October 14, 2016, trying to explain this to what he called the university community. And he indicated that I'm not being suspended because of my teaching, because of my research, because of my publications. It has to do with YouTube, my YouTube publications, and social media. And those social media, he goes on to say, and YouTube's, have been characterized as being anti-Semitic, supportive of Holocaust denial, and conspiracy theories. And, of course, these are weaponized terms. You don't want to be called anti-Semitic. You don't want to be called a conspiracy theorist. You don't want to be called a Holocaust denier. He says that there was no influence from outside agencies, outside political lobbies. And yet he says that my work on social media and YouTube has been characterized as anti-Semitic, supportive of Holocaust denial, and conspiracy theory. So who is doing this characterizing? He says some external agency is characterizing me in such a way, and yet he's saying no external agencies are involved. And, of course, the takeover of a university administration and the takeover of curriculum and academic matters and teaching staffing and all those kind of issues, if outside political lobbies of any sort can simply interject themselves into the governance of universities, you know, that's a very terrible precedent. And certainly the B'nai B'rith Canada, who publicized the Facebook operation, they went on to say, you know, I should be investigated, they had a petition, I should be fired, essentially I should be burned at the stake as some kind of heretic. So the idea that universities give themselves over to outside influences, political lobbies, very powerful lobbies, this obviously is not something that we want to see happen in our universities, and yet we know it is happening. It's happening in many ways and on many fronts.
It happened here in the U.S. at the University of Colorado Boulder with Ward Churchill after 9/11 for the essay he wrote comparing people at the Trade Center to little Eichmanns, a reference to Adolf Eichmann. It was a Nazi bureaucrat. That he was part of that war machine and part of the machine of genocide, in other words. And years after he wrote it, you know, he was investigated and suspended and lost his job. And then, of course, it turned into a witch hunt about plagiarism or a bunch of other things, changing the subjects, right, which sounds somewhat similar in your case.
Yeah.
And even though he was vindicated, ultimately, at the end, he still did not get his job back.
The intervention of, could I say, the Zionist lobby into the internal affairs of university is, you know, quite widespread. Campus Watch, there's all kinds of organizations, Hillel, that intervene on campus. Many times this intervention has to do with BDS, boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. I'm targeted, among others, on a website called Canary Mission, which essentially is a blacklisting site. aimed at those who support BDS, aimed at students and faculty alike. Ilani Pape is one of those on that blacklist. So, you know, David Ray Griffin, his very close colleague and friend, Richard Falk, has been targeted. Richard Falk did UN investigations into the treatment of Palestinians. His friend at Santa Barbara, William Robinson, was teaching about Palestinian issues and the human rights of Palestinian peoples, and he was targeted at the University of California in Santa Barbara, and he's written a book about it and really laid out the techniques which I see being applied on my own campus. I actually wrote an article about it, preparing in the summer of 2016 when I thought the B'nai B'rith Canada seemed to be taking an unusual interest in me, and I was sort of anticipating something unfortunately was about to happen. So this issue, of course, you know, is pervasive, and it's very divisive. And, of course, you know, we want to be very clear that we don't want to have slurs against ethnic groups in our curriculum. We've studied power, and we need to understand that 9/11, for example, is a hugely transformative event. It affected the way the 21st century is unfolding on major levels, and David Ray Griffin has written a book about that. And so it's very important that we have on campus, in the curriculum, in our research, in our pedagogy, in our community service, we have the capacity to have a real debate about what happened on 9/11. I think there's a very broad consensus among educated people who actually can think independently that the official story of 9/11 does not conform with the evidence. It's an audacious lie, in fact, and it's really insulting to the intelligence. It speaks of a certain attitude towards the public as very uncritical and not able to think for themselves. And yet this story is perpetuated, and it's a kind of becoming like a religious fable almost. There's sort of the suggestion if you question this story, it's like heresy or something.
I agree with you that 9/11, the official story, is false. I don't have any question saying that. I've been saying that for 16 years. But, you know, there's many other pieces of all of this as we've gone through the decades. Certainly, administrations and governments don't like us saying that. And I've taken some heat on my campus for speaking out on these issues, having Stephen Jones come and give a presentation on Building 7 and things like that. But we continue to look at what's new and what's important, and we continue to try to avoid speculation on things and say, oh, this person did it or this group did it, without adequate evidence. And in particular, but what's most concerning with me, with your story, is that someone posted this really racist post on your Facebook page, and then it's implied that you agree with it, but you didn't. I mean, I read what was there, and I just immediately knew that that was absurd, that you would have ever written anything like that. But that fact that that happened, and it gave your university president a niche to lay you off, is very concerning. As a full professor myself and Mickey, we both strongly support academic freedom and the ability to talk about these issues openly and to call it what we think when we think something's incorrect or beyond the evidence, and we'll say it. And we try to do that in a very open way.
I've tried to contact the American Association of University Professors because I think the agenda here to shut me down and make an example of me, try to ruin me professionally, this is meant to send out a signal to scare others so they don't get the courage to do what Dr. Griffin is suggesting and actually go into this issue and realize, although it may be difficult if enough of us do it with integrity and are able to go with the evidence and have our disagreements in a proper way, the fact that the universities have not done that, that Noam Chomsky was very outspoken in terms of condemning people who would look at 9/11. We're looking at a situation where the peace movement has become kind of defunct And I think you can't have a good analysis of the wars we're in unless you understand how were these wars justified, where did it start. It had a lot to do with what actually happened on 9/11. And if you have an incorrect view of what happened on 9/11, you're not going to have a good analysis of how the war machine is presently operating. So it's vital on many levels that we preserve the ground to have these discussions and debates. And on 9/11, we need a lot more think tanks, a lot more conferences, a lot more security for real discussions, because it's a very complex matter with many, many facets. And the whodunit story, if we had a credible explanation from officialdom of what happened, we wouldn't have to go there. But the explanation we've been given is so unlikely, is so far removed from what the evidence tells us, that of course we're going to speculate. And to expect that there are honest parties left when the media is this committed to back up a certain narrative, how could they back off that position at this late date? The cover-up has become the biggest part of the crime, in my view. And who is leading the cover-up? And where do you see the center of gravity? And I have to say that over the years, I've noticed that Israel First partisans tend to be the most vociferous critics of anybody looking at 9/11, whether they're looking at an Israeli connection or not, even if they're just talking about Building 7. Who is pushing back and defending the official story? So that's part of my thinking. Anyway, I appreciate this ability to talk openly with you, and I congratulate you at Project Censored for really, in a way, pioneering a discussion on this matter, because it's been kind of lonely and frustrating to not be able to speak to a broader audience about the serious things I'm seeing happening around me.
Well, Tony Hall, we appreciate you coming on the program. We certainly are proponents of academic freedom. We think it's important that when academic freedom is at stake with individuals, whether they're agreed with or not by other parties, it's really important to stand up for the principles of academic freedom. We know that's what you're doing right now at the center of your struggle. So, Tony Hall, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Okay, cheerio.
Land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
This is the Project Censored Show. We air on roughly 40 stations around the U.S. from Maui to New York. Peter Phillips and I are executive producers and co-hosts. Anthony Fest is our producer. Erica Bridgman, our engineer. To learn more about Project Censored and our parent nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation, go to projectcensored.org. To hear past programs and special Project Censored podcasts with our associate co-hosts, Nolan Higdon, Nick Bayham, and Desiree McSwain, go to the Project Censored page /radio. Click on our podcast and Patreon page. Follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll see you next time.
Visualize alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip the brothers in